Yeah. So Brooks Richards relate.
Well, Colonel Anstruther, my commanding officer, liked the sound of Cap Sarah, so he gave me the job of taking a party of our young French volunteers from the Algiers Resistance, who by this time had all been put into battle dress and given at least some armament. They got Bren guns and Sten guns and pistols. We had some Brens and some rifles, but not very many. And so I went straight back to Tabarka with about 20 of these chaps, and asked Nigel Dickinson please to run a whole lot of us back to Cap Sarah, where there was a little jetty used for landings to the lighthouse. But in fact, more than a mile from the lighthouse, down at the foot of the cliff on the top of which the lighthouse stood. So we went up, landed there, and Perrin helped us get installed. I asked the French Vichy sailors, gave them the option of either being repatriated behind the lines in landing craft or volunteering to serve with my unit. One of them volunteered, and the others opted for being sent behind the lines. So we packed them into the landing craft and sent them back. And we were just installing ourselves in the lighthouse and the semaphore station, signal station, when great clatter of approaching vehicle, and I looked out and there was a Bren gun carrier pulling up in front of the lighthouse, which had come by land up a road from Sedjanan, which was clear enough on the map, but this was Hamish Torrance, the number two of the little SOE Brandon mission. That was the code name of the SOE mission in Tunisia. And Hamish brought me some stores, I think, and we planned that we'd keep ourselves victualled this way up this road from Sedjanan. But he took his leave and went back, and I'd arrived up there with, amongst other things, a horse which we'd put in the landing craft and brought up. I'd been given the horse by Kilikini, the Contore Civil, sign of his goodwill. I'd been given a burnous by the Caid, and they'd given me, which was more valuable than the burnous at least, a certain amount of flour, which was likely to be a commodity much in demand by the local villagers. And they thought, really, I'd been invested with the goodwill and authority of the French Protectorate Administration, as far as Mr. Kilikini was concerned, and he said, please would I distribute this flour as I thought fitting among his villages up there. And it was perfectly obvious, talking to Perrin, that the main difficulty we had was that the population was sullenly hostile to the French in general way. And that their normal market towns were either Bizerta or other places lying behind what was rapidly becoming the Axis lines, or had become by then the Axis lines in front of us, because the attempt that had been made in early December to break through to Tunis by something called Blade Force had miscarried, and they tried going east, going making a dash for Tunis from Tibourba, having gone up through Medjez El Bab inland, but they couldn't get through, and the Germans arrived in too great numbers. So Tunis, being untakeable, we were faced with a winter campaign and with lines, north and south, up and down Tunisia, representing our respective positions. And Kap Sarah was the northern end of the Allied line, in effect. So a position of some importance, as events had transpired. Well, the thought with this supply of flour was that the villagers, if they could get flour from me, they wouldn't need to go through the German lines, wouldn't therefore be available to be interrogated by the Germans as to what we were up to on our side. Well, it was a good idea as far as it went, but I decided that we'd got a no-man's land of some miles wide, or some kilometres wide, anyhow, ahead of us, between where we'd spotted the Germans and our own position. And we'd really better take some more positive measures to make sure that the Arabs didn't side too actively with the Axis troops as they arrived. So we went round and we took hostages, on the advice of Perrin, from the families of the headmen of all these villages that were in the no man's land, and we made it very clear to the headmen that their eldest sons were going to be held in perfect safety, but that they would be regarded as hostages for the good behaviour of the village, and that if the village saw any Axis forces moving through, they were to light a smoky fire, if it was by day, and I can't remember what the night arrangements were, if any, but anyhow, we rounded up quite a number of these young men, and we shipped them all by landing craft back to Tabarka, and they were put in some safe place, in charge of the field security police, I suppose. But on the day following our arrival, I'd set out on my horse, wearing a burnous over my naval uniform, as I had been in my attempt to get through to Bizerta, when I'm riding along this quite unmetal track leading to Sedjanan, when I noticed that we were in the middle of a number of rather molehill-like looking bumps in the road. And as a sailor, unaccustomed to the ways of infantry warfare, it took a few seconds for Penny to drop that I'd actually ridden into a minefield which had been laid during that night. So I got the horse out backwards with some difficulty and out of the minefield before it detonated anything. But we had to give up any idea of supplying the lighthouse overland from Sedjanan until this road had passed into Allied control and was kept free of mines. So I had to rethink my lines of communication. So it was either sea or nothing at that moment. And the weather turned rather nasty because we were in the middle of the winter. And the eventual plan that was hit upon was that when we couldn't get... Well, yes, we used landing craft initially, but then one of them was actually wrecked, supplying us. Poor Jed Mansfield in command, and the Navy weren't obviously going to go away throwing away landing craft in order to get us our compo rations. I arranged that supplies would be delivered some miles further west, where the next road came through to the coast, at a place called Sidi Meshrig, and I got hold of four camels and a couple of mules, and having requisitioned these, I had a camel train which padded its way between Sidi Meshrig and Kap Sarah. And some years later, I ran into Nigel Dickinson, who had by then become the last white admiral in charge of the Indian Navy. He was visiting Greece at the time, and he said, "Brooks, I've looked for you for months. I always wanted to know whether those camels were a proper charge on naval funds." Frightfully sorry, I had to say, "No, they weren't. They were SOEs." Well, he said the Admiralty paid for them anyhow. So there we were, up in our lighthouse. And for quite a long time, the Germans didn't really start making life intolerable for us. So we had a good deal of patrolling activity of our own forward across this no man's land, keeping touch with the villagers and making sure where the Italians and Germans were, but it was the wet season, and the only road running east to Bizerta was just impassable for vehicles at that stage. So the Germans made no attempt to thrust through that way, and all the fighting on any scale took place on and around the main road running east from Sedjanan. But that was not irregular warfare, that was proper infantry warfare. And there was, some very severe fighting there, and just south of it, the Guards Division had a really quite hard period of weeks there. But up where we were, it was all very small-scale stuff, and the Italians once got through as far as the river and mounted below Perrin's farm and mounted an ambush there, which killed and wounded the guard that we were placing on it that night. But by great good fortune, the guard was accompanied by an American Ranger company who'd just come up just for a couple of days patrolling. And the Italians, having run into these Rangers, concluded that we were much more numerous at Kap Sarah than we actually were. We were never more than 40. And that was a bit of very good luck. But we assembled anyhow. We built up the original party. I eventually ended with a nice RNVR New Zealander naval doctor called Paul Chin, and an ex-foreign legionary called Johnny Warren, who had deserted from the lifeguards before joining the Foreign Legion and had then attempted to desert from the Foreign Legion to get to Gibraltar during the war, and had been apprehended and chucked into a concentration camp at Lagoat. Well, he got out and he joined me. He became my number two. Then I had four young French subalterns, all bright lights of the Algiers resistance, but average age about 20 or 19, including one fellow who's still a close friend of mine, called Henri Rosencher, who was almost a full-fledged doctor and who must have been all of 23, a very interesting little man, whom more later. But Rosanger was invaluable before Chin came, because he dealt with any casualties we had and bound people up and amputated a hand on one occasion using kitchen knives at Perrin Farm. Chap had blown his hand off. When it came to Christmas, the news came through over the radio that Darlon had been assassinated. And my French subalterns came to see me, and they said, well, we didn't like to mention this before, we thought it would embarrass you, but we all actually drew straws the honour of going and doing this before we came up. And it fell to Bonnet La Chapelle, and we were very upset indeed to hear he's been executed. So, it was rather curious thing to have on one's doorstep. But we were all absolutely delighted to think Darlon was out of the way. And it was, in fact, a major service to the Allied cause, because it got the Allies out of a very nasty cul-de-sac that Roosevelt's Vichy policy had got them into. And there's no doubt that the effect in France of our dealing with Darlon as the second senior man in the Vichy regime would have been absolutely disastrous. The effect would have been that the communists would have claimed that they were the only people who weren't tainted with compromise as far as Vichy was concerned, and they know it would have emerged as the main force of the French resistance instead of merely one of the main strands of it, the other being those who were wholeheartedly behind de Gaulle one way or another. So that the equation which ultimately made it impossible for the communists to stage a takeover in 1944 would have been quite different. The equation there being that apart from the Free French and the communists, there were also all the direct SOE French section, F section, structures in France who were directly under SOE control. So these three ingredients between them, though we fused them all for purposes of operations in June 1944, meant that there was not a situation which could be readily taken over by the communists as there might otherwise have been. And anyhow, we managed not at all badly up at Cap Serra one way and another. I found that feeding Frenchmen on compo ration as supplied to the British Army was not at all easy, because anything that didn't contain red meat, bread, and red wine really wasn't regarded as acceptable grub by French soldiers. So we had to bake our own bread. We had to arrange to buy livestock off Perrin, and then we then came across a fascinating situation in which my crew, as they were, of about 30 people up there, didn't contain anybody who knew anything about butchery. And so I asked if anyone had this relevant experience, as we wanted some sheep slaughtered, and they said no. They, none of them knew, and none of them volunteered, so I had to go and do it myself. I'd never slaughtered an animal before. But I thought, really, I'd better show the way, and it proved surprisingly easy. The interesting thing was that they were tremendously surprised to find somebody purporting to be a British officer prepared to deal with them in this kind of way, not at all the way that the French army dealt with them. And it engendered a good deal of goodwill. They really came to, I think, get on well with me, and we formed a very happy unit. Though we had some trouble with some bad hats, one of the chaps who arrived turned out to be a well-known crook, and a foreign legionary who joined us brought his copybook very severely by molesting women in one of the local villages. But most of them were absolutely splendid people. And our small-scale war continued without major disaster of any sort until one day on foot arrived from Sidi Meshrig group captain Atchley, who was one of two brothers of that name, one of whom had been the Schneider Cup pilot. I never know one from the other. This one was Batchley, I think was not the Schneider Cup pilot. Anyhow, he had a look at the site and he said, well, it had been agreed at the Casablanca conference between Churchill and Roosevelt that a new toy that the RAF had got called Ground Controlled Interception, GCI, could be installed in the front line for the first time, notwithstanding the security implications of doing so. And this was obviously the ideal place, because if he put an installation up on top of our hill, it would be able to detect Axis aircraft taking off from Sardinia and landing at Eloina or Bizerta. And this, with the approaching end of the campaign in the spring, as we hoped, would be of great importance. So he was going to recommend that a GCI installation be brought in and put on top of the hill. But Churchill and Roosevelt had agreed that there would have to be 4,000 troops to guard it, to make sure it wasn't easily overrun. So the RAF regiment had been told to provide 4,000 men to come up and install themselves at Cap Serrat. Well, I said, that's absolutely fine, and I'll stay on until you've got installed, but obviously it's no longer going to be my kind of war up here, so I'll see you in and then I'll withdraw. So they brought the heavy equipment in from Sejanan, clearing the road through and putting down brushwood and what was taken to make the road vehicle worthy. They brought this heavy installation in and the troops to guard it. I gave them the local knowledge, the contact with Perrin, and Perrin's son in fact joined the RAF regiment and indeed saw the rest of the campaign through with them, being extremely valuable with his French and Arabic. But in the early days of February 1943, I said goodbye to them and withdrew with my detachment of what was officially designated number one special detachment, alias abandoned mission. And oddly enough, within a very short time, 3 weeks I think or so of the RAF regiment taking over, the roads through to Bizerta had dried out sufficiently for the Germans to make a major probe through that way, and they came right through with armoured vehicles to Cap Serrat. The radar tubes have got to be taken out by sea just in time. The vehicles had to be thrown over the cliff to prevent them falling into German hands, and the whole area was under German hands for some days, but not for all that long. But at any rate, I went back then to my proper naval section duties, and it was already clear that as the 8th Army came up from the Marath Line and the 1st Army got ready to make a push for Tunis, that the last area that the Axis powers would hold in Tunisia would be Tunis and the Cap Bon Peninsula, which runs northeast from it. So Anstruther, or I think by that time he'd actually been, he'd been replaced by somebody called Jimmy Young, a nice Scotsman who had been a tea planter in Ceylon and collected two MCs in the First World War. And he worked out a plan whereby he put a group of 10 with radio, with a radio operator amongst them, into the Cap Bon Peninsula by sea from the east to see what damage they could do in this area, which looked as though it would be the last redoubt. So I was sent off to Malta with this party, the 10 little bears, we called them, led by a man called Acquaviva, Corsican. And I arranged with the naval authorities in Malta that I could have two motor gunboats from the Malta flotilla to do an operation, landing them to a reception party which we expected at a place called Kelibia on the southern end of the Cap Bon Peninsula, a place that was very easily identifiable from seaward because a British destroyer that had been either bombed or torpedoed in the one of the Malta convoys, HMS Havoc, had been run ashore there on the beach, and her crew in turn to the French at La Guayette. But this wreck was a very good pinpoint, so I should have said that Brandon Mission had sent a chap called Mallory, who was an RAF squadron leader who knew Tunis, had been, I think, had a job there before the war, making cement or something of that sort, but who was also a radio operator. They sent him into Tunis, and he remained in radio contact, and it was to Mallory that I was expecting to land my 10 little bears. And Mallory gave us password and light signal, and we set off from Malta with these two boats, and the light signal was